I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Despite an up-and-down season so far this year, the Kansas City Royals have claimed their spot as one of baseball's top franchises, according to our first guest, and fans can't seem to get enough. Today we hear stories from the dugout, locker room, and press box from former pitcher and current broadcaster Jeff Montgomery. Then, Kansas City is the wealthiest in Kansas, but there are tens of thousands of residents living in poverty, and they're often hiding in plain sight. We'll hear about the unique challenges they face every day and learn about strategies policymakers can use to give them a helping hand. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Former reliever Jeff Montgomery saved more games for the Royals than anyone in team history. When Montgomery retired in 1999, he had saved more than 300 games. That ranked him ninth on Major League Baseball's all-time list. These days, Montgomery's in his eighth season as part of the Royals broadcast team. He's out with a new book co-written with Matt Foulkes. It's titled, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Kansas City Royals Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. And Jeff, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be in. Thank you.
Two outs in the bottom of the ninth. The opposing team is down by a run, Jeff, and they've got runners on base. Why were you able to manage the tensions of moments like that?
I think the biggest thing about those circumstances, they maybe brought out the best in me. As a 5'10", 175-pound relief pitcher who didn't throw extremely hard, I had to find ways to make myself, you know, 6'5" and 300 pounds and throw 100 miles an hour. And those situations brought that out in me. Not that I could ever throw 100 miles an hour, but it made me feel like I could. It gave me confidence. It gave me a lot of feeling that I could be successful regardless of really what my natural abilities were. And I just found ways to, I think, essentially get the most out of what I was gifted with. And those situations, oftentimes not right for every relief pitcher, but for me, they were the right circumstances, and again, I think they made me better.
Now that's the physical part of all this, Jeff. What about sort of the psychological, the emotional, having all that pressure, all your teammates, everyone in the stands watching you on that mound?
Well, I always felt that throwing a baseball 60'6" was the thing that I was best at in this entire world. As a result, I had a lot of confidence that I could go out there and really trust myself. And confidence is such a key in anything we do, but especially when you're playing baseball at the highest level. And in those situations, and I don't know if I would have been the same pitcher if I were a starting pitcher, if I were pitching in the fifth inning. But those seventh, eighth, and ninth inning situations when I had a chance to go in and finish a game, and believe me, finishing a game at the major league level with a victory and shaking your teammates, your coaches, your managers, hearing the crowd explode, it's one of the most gratifying sensations that you can experience. And I really kind of thrived on that, and I really enjoyed, you know, being in those situations. Now, as good as that was, when you would fail, it was equally as bad. And I think I hated the feeling when I didn't perform and when I failed more than I loved the feeling when I did perform.
And now, what is that about? Sometimes I do that here. You have a bad show, and that just hangs with you for a while, more so than a good show does.
I think the biggest thing is for someone who's a relief pitcher, especially a closer in baseball, you're supposed to be successful, and everyone expects it from you. You expect it from yourself. And when you don't do it, it's, you know, essentially you're the GOAT. I equate it a lot of times to field goal kickers in the NFL. When they miss that field goal to put your team into the playoffs, that's the guy that everybody points to. Now, if he makes that field goal, hey, hats off, nice job. But that's what you were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's as much maybe focus and not as much criticism when you're doing your job. But I think we as individuals who expect a lot from ourselves, we're harder on ourselves when we don't perform as much as we are when we do perform and we pat ourselves on the back.
Former Royal great Jeff Montgomery is my guest. You write in here, Jeff, that getting the final three outs in a baseball game are the toughest three outs of the game. That, of course, is when you were on the mound. And I'm wondering, why is that? Because on one level, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's really different. I think that was another thing that really kind of made me a little bit better in those situations. I was able to take that. Normally, you're going to have at least a one-run lead, sometimes two- or three-run lead, and I would use that to my advantage, thinking, you know, I've got the upper hand here. I'm able to do my job and you know, stop the other team from scoring a run or two or three runs, whatever the lead may be. But you're always in the advantage when you're ahead. And I think that's the thing. You really kind of put the pressure on the opposition as opposed to putting that pressure on yourself.
You said something in the book that surprised me. You would rather face a big, burly home run hitter like Albert Bell, who was the, you know, the big hitter for the Indians when you were still playing, than a hitter like skinny little Kenny Lofton, who also played for the Indians. You call batters like Lofton fleas or gnats, meaning what?
They just wouldn't go away. You know, and the big free swinging power hitters. I was a pitcher who threw four pitches: a fastball, curveball, changeup, and slider. And my best pitch probably was my slider. And a slider is a pitch that's designed actually to finish off the plate. It should look like a strike and finish out of the strike zone for a ball. But big, strong, burly hitters, they like to hit those pitches a long way. And if you really play that to your advantage, you can be better as a result, because they're going to be swinging at pitches that are balls. And the Kenny Loftons of the world, those gnats or fleas, as I called them, they were just the guys that they would keep fouling off those pitches, and they would keep themselves in those plate appearances and find a way to, you know, put the bat on the ball or, you know, draw a walk or whatever. It just seemed like they were a lot more work to get out than the big free swinging guys who they're either going to hit a home run or strike out.
What don't most people understand about the difficulty of finishing out a game?
Well, I think if fans who watched the Royals game the other day against the Toronto Blue Jays, their closer was not available. And the Blue Jays had a lead in the ninth inning, and they bring out three different relief pitchers, and they just failed to get that final out. And finally, Whit Merrifield hits the double down the line, driving in two runs to win the ball game. And I said after the game, I said, that's a good example of those last three outs being the most difficult ones to secure, because not everyone's cut out for that. And when the Blue Jays closer was essentially unavailable, it put other guys in situations where they were now forced to try to get those last three outs. And as we saw, they were not able to do it, fortunately for the Royals.
Do you think hitters are more alive, more awake, more familiar with the feel of the game in the ninth inning than in the first inning? Does that resonate with you at all?
There's focus. There's an understanding. We're down to our last at bat.
This is it.
And oftentimes the other thing that changes in that last inning is the opposing manager has these guys on the bench that may be, you know, able to pinch hit or pinch run or get a bunt down. He can bring in everyone he's got left. In other words, he's going to empty his holster here to try to find a way to beat you. So that's another thing that maybe makes the ninth inning a little more difficult than the other seven or eight innings.
There's no holding back at that point.
No holding back. You're going to use every element that you have available to try to win a game.
So, again, it's the ninth inning, and the catcher comes out to the mound to talk to you. What does he say?
A lot of times you just say, hey, take a deep breath here. Stay within yourself. Don't try to overdo it. A lot of times pitchers get themselves in trouble when they try to overthrow the baseball. In other words, you're trying too hard sometimes, and you get out of your game. You get out of your mechanics, and that catcher, who's the closest player to the action, to the pitcher, he can see that oftentimes. And sometimes it's mechanical. Sometimes it's your pitching arm, the slot that you normally pitch from, it drops down a little bit because you're a little too fast. You're trying to overthrow, and things just go haywire. So they just come out to really kind of settle you down a little bit. Just come out to try to get you to, hey, relax. Don't try to overthrow the baseball. Get right back in your mechanics and repeat that delivery.
Jeff, you were known for making fans sweat in games because many times you'd walk the first hitter or even two that you faced, and you'd load the bases you know, did you do that on purpose?
I did not do that on purpose. It so made me sweat.
You'd say that.
I remember John Watheny, he took his hat off one time. He was my first manager here with the Royals. He took his hat off one time. He said, look at these hairs. See why they're so gray? He said, you're making one gray every time you go out there. Let's make this a little more, a little quicker. Let's get this over with. But I think that's one thing that, you know, if I did give up a hit or I walked a guy, and have, you know, more of a critical situation, it made me better. It made me essentially rise to the occasion. So I think that's sometimes why I would kind of create my own, you know, disaster and then find a way to get out of it.
I'm wondering if it's fair to say that your accomplishments in the game exceeded your reputation. And to that end, you point out in the book that you never had a nickname like some relievers did, you know, the Mad Hungarian, for instance. You were always this clean-cut, well-composed guy who did his job and didn't make a big deal out of it.
I think a lot of guys have maybe really unique personalities. I'm really kind of more like the guy next door.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, my teammates said, you know, you really don't come across as a guy that's going to, you know, be able to perform at that level in those situations. But
you're a computer science major, Jeff, just to remind our audience. Yeah.
That's true. But the whole thing is I felt like that doesn't harm me, but it doesn't do me any good to have that exuberant personality. I just felt like on that mound, as a relief pitcher, especially a closer, I'm pitching to the situation. So there's a lot of things going on up in my little brain, trying to figure out what's the best approach or what's the best thing I can do. And I would always try to eliminate situations where the hitter had advantages or the other team had advantages. I would always try to use the situation to my favor and really kind of pitch to the odds, almost like I'm playing blackjack. I'm not going to take a hit, you know, if I've got 17. I might take a hit if I got 12. I'm sure not going to take a hit if I'm 20. And if I'm out there on the mound, I'm kind of thinking through pitching in the situations almost like I'm playing cards, mm-hmm. knowing that I want to eliminate. I want to play the odds in my favor, basically.
I think fans would have loved to have gotten inside your head in moments like that and sort of seen what you're contemplating, what you're weighing, what kinds of decisions you're making.
And those are things that you really just kind of develop, you know, whether you do it at a young age in your amateur career or you develop that as you become a professional. But it's just something that some guys have a totally different approach. And like as an example, there's so much information available on hitters, particularly in today's game.
Mm-hmm.
And there are meetings, and you talk about, you know, this hitter, his weaknesses, his strengths, and you go through all these. And we had scouting reports when I played, but we didn't have near the level of information. And we would go into these meetings with the pitchers and catchers and pitching coach, and we'd talk about all the hitters on the opposing team the first day we're going to play them in a series. And I would always almost put a set of imaginary earplugs in my ears because I didn't want to hear all of that because I wanted to pitch my game. I wanted to be out there and react and do what I felt like was best for me because, in my opinion, what's good for one pitcher may not be exactly the same recipe for another pitcher. And I just felt like my ability to crunch through That's those really situations on the fly was best for me rather than trying to have this pre-planned action on what we're going to do in a game.
Jeff Montgomery's new book, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Kansas City Royals Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. Explain this to me, Jeff. You say the line between really good and really bad at the major league level is nearly invisible. Why?
Well, I really learned that to the nth degree my last year of playing, because I felt okay. I felt like I was physically okay, and I was, you know, during my bullpen sessions, all my warm-ups, I felt exactly the way I did when I was, and at that time I was 37, but I felt the same as I did when I was 27, when I was 17, no difference. The difference was the hitters were letting me know loud and clear that something's not the same because I'm giving up home runs, I'm backing up bases, and you know, just things weren't going well for me at all. And I eventually learned that it was a hip injury that was really kind of limiting my abilities to perform at the highest level. But you just don't recognize it. And I've said it's, you know, it's like walking down the sidewalk. There's a crack in the sidewalk. You see it and you step over it. But sometimes those cracks are almost like trying to step over the Grand Canyon when something's not there. But it's so difficult at times to recognize just how deep that, you know, that crack is, and can you make it or can you not make it?
Jeff Montgomery's in the house here. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You have a list in If These Walls Could Talk of the most dangerous hitters you ever faced. One of those is Paul Molitor, who played for the Brewers, and I've often thought that if he had avoided injuries, he just might have passed Ty Cobb for the most hits in a career. Tell us about facing Paul Molitor.
Well, Paul Molitor was a guy whose his mechanics at the plate were very basic. They were very simple. In fact, he didn't even stride. You see a lot of hitters, they will stride with their front foot toward the pitcher. Paul Molitor hit flat-footed, and he had such great hands and such enormous bat speed that if you made a mistake, he's going to hit it a long way. But also, you could throw a really good pitch, a pitch that was down and away on the outside corner. And I, at times, I felt like the ball was actually in the catcher's glove. And next thing I know, I'm looking up, and he's hit the ball down the right field line for a double or a triple just because of his athletic ability and his ability to get to that bat head out to the outside corner of the plate so quickly. He was just amazing with regards to how quick he was. And he was just a solid all-around player that was going to grind out every at-bat. There was never an easy at-bat against Paul Molitor. And I remember one time I was facing Paul Molitor. He was playing for the Twins at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was bases loaded. It was a tie game. Last inning, and I had I'd thrown two pitches away, fastball away, slider away. So I'm ahead in the count, no balls, two strikes. And I want to throw another pitch away on the outside corner. But in order to do that, since I'd already thrown two pitches away, I want to come inside on Paul Molitor. And I throw a pitch to the inside part of the plate, and it wasn't even a ball. It's probably going to be a strike. And he leans into it, and it hits him on the sleeve of his jersey for a hit batter, and drove in the winning run.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think he inherently knew that I was going to be coming up and in on him to kind of set up my next pitch.
Right.
And he knew that. He leans into it and won the ballgame.
That's interesting. How about Kirby Puckett, one of the guys I watched a lot growing up?
Yeah, just one of the most, first of all, a great ball player, but more than that, just a tremendous personality,
mm-hmm.
a real competitor, a guy that you may see him at 6 o'clock in the evening, during batting practice, and he might be joking around with you. But when he climbs in that batter's box later on that evening in the seventh or eighth inning, he's going to give you an at bat. And he could hit a pitch that was neck high. He could hit a pitch that was ankle high. And playing that Metrodome with the AstroTurf, it was unbelievable how hard Kirby Puckett could hit a baseball right back up the pitcher's box, right mm-hmm. up the middle. I felt at times like I was pitching in a bowling alley with
that's
Kirby.
That's what
Puckett.
You say in the book. Yeah,
yeah, it's just unbelievable how he and really a lot of the Twins, when they played on that turf, they used that field to their advantage because it's a fast turf, and they would just hit the ball on the ground hard up the middle, and next thing you know, those balls are rolling to the wall.
Even as a fan, I would go in there. I could not see the ball against the ceiling when it was a pop fly. I don't know how players did, and that's I always thought they won a World Series because of that, I think. Jeff, put some headphones on there. I'm going to take a couple calls here at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Joe from Lenexa. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. I wanted to ask about the transition from being a starting pitcher to being a relief pitcher. I'm assuming you were a starting pitcher in high school, maybe in college, but at some point you transitioned from being a starter to a reliever. And I'd like to know what that was. And do you see Matt Strom long-term as a starter or a reliever? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Yeah, sure, Joe. I'll go in reverse order. Yes, I do see Matt Strom being a starting pitcher. I think he's got the stuff. He's got the build. He's going to put on some weight and some mass on his body. I think he's going to be a durable starting pitcher. So that's, I think he's in the right role. He's done a very nice job as a reliever, but I think also he's more valuable to his club. Almost like Danny Duffy, was really good as a reliever. Put him in a rotation, let him be a guy that goes out there and gives you some quality innings every fifth day.
Mm-hmm.
And then with regards to my transition, I was a starting pitcher in high school and in college. I was drafted by the Cincinnati Reds in 83. I report to Billings, Montana, and they have probably a 3 or 4 day little mini camp before our season started, all the guys who had just been drafted. And I was throwing batting practice, and my manager, who was about my size actually, he calls me aside one day. He said, "Look," he goes, "I'm going to try you in the bullpen. What do you think about pitching in relief?" I said, "Well," his name was Mark Bombard. I said, "Bombie, I'm not so sure that I can relieve." I said, "Because I know when I start, you know, I'll pitch a game and, you know, for two or three days, it's like I don't even feel like I can brush my teeth without having, you know, pain in my arm and my elbow and everything. So I don't know how I'll respond. He goes, "Will you just be pitching an inning or two at a time? Let's give it a shot." He goes, "I really like the way that you are able to throw strikes. So you got, you know, you have a variety of pitches. Let's put you in relief and see what happens." So my first appearance as a professional athlete was as a relief pitcher. So I became a relief pitcher immediately in my professional career, and I went through about 4 or 5 years. Eventually, my last season in the minor leagues, I was a starting pitcher. I was promoted to the major leagues as a starting pitcher, and I made one start in a major league. So 700 career games, 699 relief, one start in the major leagues. And so I get traded to the Royals before the 88 season, and the first person I saw in the clubhouse was John Schuerholz. And he was the Royals general manager. He said, "We really like your numbers better as a reliever than as a starter. We're going to send you to Omaha to be a relief pitcher again." So really kind of the wind went out of my sails the first day of spring training, knowing that I don't have a chance to make the club out of spring training. But I really appreciate the opportunity that they gave me to go to Omaha and become a relief pitcher again. And because at the time we had Dan Quisenberry, we had Gene Garber, we had some guys who had a lot of career experience as closers. So it all worked out well in the end, but that was my transition.
Obviously that made sense for you. And the arm pain was manageable as a reliever?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it was just a matter of pitching every day was better for me than pitching once and then, you know, throwing 100-plus pitches. And so I never had any arm pain as a reliever.
Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on with Jeff Montgomery. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeff. I want your comments, please, on the Major League Baseball plans they have underway. They're hoping to make the games last less time instead of 3, 4, 5 hours. And a couple of the things they mentioned was having the pitcher, basically once they get the ball back, to pitch within a shorter amount of time instead of waiting more time. And the other one was to reduce the number of times that the catcher can come out and speak to you on the mound to make the game go a little bit quicker. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. How about speeding up the game, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm okay with speeding up the game. I don't really like any part of the game that has a time clock on it because we're the only sport that doesn't have a clock. And I think that's one thing that makes baseball unique. But I think there are ways to do it without a clock. I don't really like the clock idea as far as, you know, a pitcher has to pitch within a certain time frame because I think it'll be a distraction. I think it's something that a lot of people will be looking at. It really wouldn't do a lot as far as that. Most pitchers are not going to be out there for, you know, 30 or 40 seconds between pitches. So I think they just, you know, that's one thing. But I think one thing, you can eliminate the amount of times that, you know, the manager can go to the mound. And if a pitcher's coming in from the bullpen, have him ready, get him into the game. And, if he doesn't get in by a certain time, then maybe penalize him. You know, give the hitter a ball or two balls to start the count to really make sure that they're not going to, you know, dilly-dally around on getting the relief pitcher into the game.
Because the game just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. It's right, not going the other way.
Right, and a lot of that has to do with just the fact that the offense is back. A lot of home runs and the runs are up.
That's true.
Royals average just a little under 3 hours per game, like 2 hours and 58 or 59 minutes.
Yeah. You describe in the book what a good guy Ken Griffey Jr. was, at least during his playing days. Tell us about him and what he did for your son.
Yeah, Griff was a guy that was a fierce, fierce, fierce competitor. Great player, did so many great things at a very young age. But I remember my son Connor, when he was around 10 years old, we'd go to the ballpark, and he'd come out to the ballpark with me, and he would always throw baseballs up on the screen. And there used to be a screen that would go from the screen all the way back to the press box. It was like an angle coming down. He would throw balls up on that screen. They'd roll down. He'd catch them. He'd throw them. He'd do it our entire batting practice, so like an hour straight. We were hitting, and we're playing the Mariners. Griffey's hitting group was going to be the first one up. So I'm walking off the field. I go over to the screen to get my son Connor to go into clubhouse, and Griffey comes over. He goes, "Who's this young man?" And I introduce him to Connor, and Connor, you know, he was really, you know, he really appreciated the fact he knew enough about baseball. And Griffey at the time was actually, you know, chasing the major league home run record, single season home run record. And he introduced himself to Connor, and Connor said, "I know."
Didn't know right away who he was, did he? Or
he said he was just. He goes, "I hope you break the record." He goes, "Just don't do it against my dad." So it was
a nice
really
thing
cool,
to say.
Really, really cool.
I love the story you tell and hear about Rex Hudler. I mean, who else, right? And he's talking about antacid pills during a broadcast, but he gets the word wrong.
Yeah.
Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. Actually, Hud is just, he's a blast to work with.
I can imagine.
And you
we've
know,
had him on the air, yeah.
And Hud has his personality, you know, for television, but he's the same guy off television.
Yeah.
He's the same guy, you know, 24/7, nonstop, always, you know, always upbeat, always positive. But yeah, we were in Chicago, and it's kind of one of the things in the, you know, in the clubhouse. You know, you're talking about, you know, a guy that didn't have much of a rear end, and somebody will say, you know, he's taking these Noacetol pills. So Hud, instead of saying antacid pills, he says that on the broadcast, and Joel Goldberg and I are behind, and Joel had never heard that before, and I told Joel what it was. We started laughing, and next thing you know, Rex and Ryan they're both laughing so hard when they realized what Hud had said, and they couldn't stop laughing. There was like a minute of dead air, which is very unusual when Hud's doing the broadcast. So.
Just a lot of dead air there.
Yeah.
Another story from the book, you mistook the great pitcher Greg Maddux for a bat boy back in 1990 when Maddux was just coming up. I think this was up in Iowa.
Right.
And what did you ask Maddux to do?
Well, so I was a starting pitcher at that stage of my career. That was when I was with the Reds starting. And I'd pitched the day before, and the following day, the starting pitcher has responsibility for the what we call the bucket. When batting practice is going, all the balls that are hit in the outfield, they throw them into the bucket. So that pitcher from the previous day collects the baseballs. When the batting practice pitcher is out of baseballs, you have to run the bucket in, and it's a terrible job. And a lot of times we would say, even though we were all broke at the time, we'd tell the bat boy from wherever we are, say, hey, I'll give you $5 if you'll do the bucket for me. And that, you know, everybody would do it, and bat boys love to get the $5. So I see the bat boy in Des Moines, Iowa, for the Cubs, and I said, would you do the bucket for me today? And he looked at me and he didn't say anything, just kind of gave me that strange look. And I'm like, wow, that's unusual. So, you know, we finished batting practice, and, you know, we're out on the in the dugout for the national anthem. Next thing I know, the anthem's over, and here comes this bat boy out to the mound, and he proceeds to throw a shutout against us. And it was not the bat boy, actually. It was Greg Maddux, who had just been called up from Double-A baseball
to
Triple-A.
Maybe one of the greatest pitchers in the history of Major League
Baseball.
Absolutely.
But he still looks young, even though he's, you know, he's got to be, you know, around 50. Yeah. He still looks like he's, you know, probably 20 years old. He looks really young, and he had that baby face when he was a youngster in Des Moines, Iowa.
Jeff Montgomery's new book, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Kansas City Royals Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. Jeff, what a pleasure to have you here. I hope the book does well, and enjoy seeing you on the broadcast so much.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk baseball. Thank you very much.
Jeff Montgomery, folks. And time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about something very different, being poor in Johnson County. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we learned about the lawlessness of the Ozarks after the Civil War. Then former Chiefs lineman Ryan O'Callaghan spoke about using football to hide his homosexuality. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we meet UMKC's new women's basketball coach, who at just 29 has one of the best resumes in the country. Also, we'll learn about a nursing school set to open in Salina, looking to attract healthcare providers to rural parts of Kansas. Well, what's keeping poor people in Kansas's richest county from joining the middle class? What can social service agencies do to help? That was the purpose of a study recently completed by a University of Kansas researcher for United Community Services of Johnson County. Focus groups were conducted with struggling families, and a series of recommendations were produced based on her findings. They included providing helping services for at least 2 years, more flexibility on qualifying for help, and better communications when help is available. Here's a not-so-fun fact. There are as many people living in poverty today in Johnson County as there are in Wyandotte County. With us now, Angela Gist is an assistant professor of communication studies at KU, and she conducted this study. And Angela, nice to have you. Welcome.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Catherine Evans Madden is a poverty project manager for United Community Services of Johnson County, which helps the community navigate big problems like poverty. And Catherine, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
We've done shows before on this idea that the number of people living in poverty in Johnson County is increasing. But Catherine, there are as many people now living in poverty in JOCO as in Wyandotte County. That's going to floor people.
Yes, it is quite a startling statistic, but it's true. You know, given the population size of Johnson County, we've got more people generally, and so it makes our poverty rate look smaller, but we actually have the same number approximately as Wyandotte County.
Well, should we be surprised by that?
I don't necessarily know that we should be surprised. I mean, the poverty has been increasing in Johnson County for the past several years.
Again, we've talked about it here, but the image of Johnson County endures in many ways.
Yes. Well, I mean, it does fly in the face of this idea of Johnson County as the wealthiest county in our region and all that. But there are people kind of hidden in the suburbs living in poverty, and it's important that we talk about it so we can figure out how to help them.
Okay. Given that, Angela, why did you decide to focus on Johnson County? What brought you here to begin with?
Yeah, so UCS had a need for their employment planning project. They wanted to understand what is that lived experience? What is the story of the person that's living in poverty in Johnson County?
Which helps them navigate how to help that person then,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so my research looks at issues of social mobility. And so we sat down in five different focus groups of people from 4 to 6 to really understand what are they dealing with on the ground.
How did you get them to talk? Because I can only imagine that some folks who are poor don't want to open up to the world about that a whole lot because maybe they feel like they've been failures on one level or another.
Yeah, so poverty is an extremely stigmatizing experience, and anytime I'm dealing with a population that's stigmatized, it's important to let them know that the findings of the research would serve populations such as them. And so having that sort of motivation will get people to share a little bit more. Also, making a space that excludes judgment. It allows them to have a space where they can speak freely and not be judged or stigmatized based on where they are in their current life circumstances.
What did you ask them?
So questions like, if you could have any job, what would that job be? What's getting in the way of you achieving that dream? Or what holds you back day to day? What kind of stresses or struggles do you deal with?
I'm not an expert on poverty, but I know a little bit about it. And it seems like a lot of times folks who are low income, you have a problem with transportation and, you know, you can't solve that. And then, you know, other problems crop up right away and things tend to snowball for people who are poor in ways that it's hard for those of us who aren't poor to imagine.
Yeah. So those issues are amplifying one another, right?
Yes.
So if you have an issue like transportation, that could also be complicated by an issue of childcare. If you're working an hourly wage shift, it can be very difficult to get across the county in time to pick your child up from daycare if you're using public transit, for example.
Yeah, one thing you found was that low-income workers need support for at least 2 years to allow them to stabilize their lives. I'm wondering why 2 years?
Yeah, so that's just sort of my informed guesstimate as to how
based
long
on your
they
interviews
would need service.
And, yeah.
And the reason I say that is because quite frequently what happens in public service programs is we put a Band-Aid on certain issues. So if you have a transportation problem, we give you a bus voucher, for example. That solves one problem for one instance, but over time, it really doesn't help people lift them out of poverty. So what I think is that if we help them holistically for a sustained period of time, and I'm throwing out the number 2 years, then that could create an upward mobility track where people could sort of avoid falling back into poverty after just receiving, for example, a bus voucher or a utility bill payment.
You know, Catherine, we're a society that's notoriously impatient. And the notion of trying to help folks for 2 years is going to jar people because people want a quick solution and they want to move on to the next problem. What do you make of this 2-year idea?
I think that that's a fair estimate. And one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that poverty is an extremely complex problem. There is no simple solution. And also, a common misconception is that when you talk about people in poverty, that population, it's not the same group in poverty year after year. People cycle in and out of poverty on a regular basis. And many of us will experience poverty at some point in our lives. And so you have to understand that there are certain circumstances and certain situations that land people in that poverty category and ways that we can help them out of it. But we've got to sort of be in it for the long haul.
And do you think social service agencies are cool with this idea of helping people for as long as 2 years?
You know, for the most part, I think social service agencies are very well set up. They have great capacity to do that kind of long-term assistance. I think what's more important, or at least as important, is making sure our public policies and public decision-making are set up to support that long-term support of people who are living in poverty.
You say poverty is complicated. And for a lot of people, it's as simple as, hey, buddy, go out and get a job and straighten your life out. Why is it complicated?
Well, you know, we all want to believe that work is a pathway out of poverty, and it really should be a pathway out of poverty. But in order for work to be a pathway out of poverty, it has to be a good job that pays a living wage, that enables people to get ahead. And the reality is that even in Johnson County, many of the jobs that are available to people don't have those opportunities. You know, about one in three of our jobs pays less than $15 an hour in Johnson County, and that's not enough.
Is 15 the threshold for a livable wage, depending on, is that the big, I guess it depends on how many kids you have and everything else.
Yeah, yeah. It depends on your household size. I mean, 15 is a pretty conservative estimate about what it takes to live in a county as expensive as Johnson County. Some estimates from researchers have shown that for a family of three, like a parent and two children, it would take about $28 an hour to meet this cost of living in Johnson County. So
are you saying then that you can work full-time in Johnson County, Kansas, or anywhere else for that matter, and still be in poverty?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, most of the poor adults in Johnson County are working. They're either working full-time or part-time, but they're not making enough money to get out of poverty. And you can see that our unemployment rate in Johnson County has radically declined in the past several years, but the poverty rate has not kind of kept up with that decline. And so that tells us that people are working, they're just not making enough to get out of poverty.
And what does that say then? I mean, how do you approach that idea if you have poor folks who are working full time and that they have kids and they're still in poverty?
Well, once again, I can't give you a simple answer because it's a complex problem, but I think there are a number of ways that you could look at this in terms of solutions. You could think about giving people more opportunities to make higher wages in jobs that pay higher wages, either through opening up training or educational opportunities. You could talk to employers about offering a living wage job threshold for their income. There are a number of different ways that we could approach this problem.
We're talking about being poor in Johnson County in a new study just completed by KU for United Community Services of Johnson County to address this issue. You know, Angela, another recommendation here, support services must be individualized. I understand that. And also holistically integrated. Mm-hmm. Those are million-dollar words. What does that mean?
Yeah, so thinking about individualized, many of our workforce programs are usually a one-size-fits-all approach. And usually when people are looking for employment, they have very specific combination of barriers that are inhibiting their ability to obtain employment. So what happens is we stick you in a program, hope that program in 6 to 9 months maybe can resolve those issues. But if they're not tailored to your specific situation, then they can sometimes leave you right where you started.
That means maybe spending more money and making these programs a little more. If you individualize something, that means a bigger investment, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So people need sort of tailored career coaching to help them achieve the type of employment that they would like that will provide satisfying and sustainable employment for them.
Okay. Another one, eligibility for services must be flexible and driven by dignity and compassion. Meaning what?
So this is a little bit of an out-of-the-box idea, but many times low-income folks are experiencing undignifying situations in the workplace and out. They're stigmatized in our society and thus sort of pushed to the margins. So what I'm finding in many of these programs is that the criteria are sort of a hard line in the sand, for example. So if you think about food stamps or the SNAP program, there's a threshold for the amount of money that you can make to qualify for different amounts of food stamps. But sometimes that threshold, if you're just $10 over it, can cut you off, but you're really not in a sustainable household where you can have food coming in on a regular basis. So I'm thinking about how we apply these types of criteria, how legislation constrains our ability to help populations in need.
Yeah.
Instead, can we have something that's driven by more compassion instead of by strict numbers is sort of the idea.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. There's this phrase out there, Catherine. I'm looking for it in my notes here, that say you're someone who's low income and you get a raise on your job, and suddenly that raise on one level sounds like that's really good, but then you find out that because you've gotten a raise, you're making too much money for this program and that program and this program, and suddenly that raise becomes something awful because your life suddenly became a lot more expensive and you can't afford it anyway.
Yeah, I think you're referring to what's called the benefits cliff.
There you go.
Or the cliff effect.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and it's a pretty common problem.
The cliff effect.
Yes.
I like how you guys have names for stuff.
Well, because if you visualize it, you know, if you want to take a dollar an hour raise, for example, but that raise will, you know, take away your food assistance that you use to feed your children, then you don't have enough money to actually buy food for your children. So you're kind of falling off that benefits cliff. And it's a structure that's built into a lot of our public benefits, unfortunately. And it causes working people to have to make some really tough choices about what kinds of jobs they'll take or whether they will take that raise that we as a society say they should take because it's going to get them ahead, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, back to the complexity of this problem, you know, when you're thinking about people in poverty who rely on public benefits to live and to feed their children, you have to think about all of these things in concert, how much they're making, what they need to get by, the cost of living. All of those factors are important to consider.
And what's coming through in what you're saying here, Catherine, is this idea that it's hard to be poor.
It is.
Doesn't sound like any fun. It's hard.
No, I don't think anyone would say that it's an ideal situation to be in. It's very difficult. You're always faced with difficult choices.
Every day.
Every single day about, you know, are you going to buy medicine or are you going to pay for your car repair so you can get to work? You know, those are not the kinds of choices that we as a society want our neighbors to have. So how can we be proactive about addressing some of those complex causes and consequences of poverty so that people don't have to make those decisions?
Angela, I'm wondering too if in your conversations with folks in Johnson County, if it came through at all that being poor, being low income in Johnson County of all places, the golden, whatever you want to call it, the golden ghetto, the, you know, the magical kingdom, streets paved with gold, I'm being facetious, but people think that sometimes, you know, how tough is it to be poor in Johnson County?
It can actually be harder to be poor in suburbs in general.
Yeah.
So, for instance, the structure, the infrastructure isn't there, because if you think about, for example, public transit, the city is built for public transit, right? And we think about how easy it is to get from point A to point B, which still isn't great in the metro area. But if you moved out to a suburb like Johnson County, it's even more difficult, because the assumption when you're building those are that people have individual forms of transportation, that you've got a personal vehicle or car. And so to get from point A to point B for a job interview, for example, can be even more difficult in a suburb like Johnson County.
Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Joanne from Overland Park. Joanne, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so grateful for this topic. I think it's really needed, and I'm appreciative. I've heard recently about the Veterans Community Project, who's creating tiny houses.
Right. We've talked about it here.
As an answer to homelessness, of course. I'm wondering, I heard about a group, I think in Detroit, perhaps, who was a nonprofit who leveled a city block and then put up tiny houses so that low-income people could have an opportunity to purchase something and not just barely get by on renting, so the same price as renting they could purchase. But I don't see that as an option in Johnson County. Is anybody working toward that? And I'll take my answer off here. Thanks.
Joanne, thank you. Tiny homes. Any thoughts here?
I have not heard, this is Catherine, I haven't heard anything about tiny homes in Johnson County, but I do know that there is a need for affordable housing in Johnson County. When it comes to the cost of living, housing is one of the heftier expenses for families of any income level in
Johnson
County.
A tiny home's not going to solve a problem for a mom with two or three kids.
Not necessarily, no. And really, what we're looking for when it comes to housing solutions is sustainable, affordable housing. And whatever form that might take is going to be helpful for families of any size who are living in poverty.
Yeah. Okay. 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Andrea from the Northland, good morning. Andrea, there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I appreciate you guys talking about the cliff. I don't know that people really understand how debilitating and hard it is for people. My sister's a mother of three, and she got a job for $12 an hour and immediately lost her food stamps and her health insurance, and it was just devastating to her, and she really had a hard time getting past it.
So in other words, she was penalized for working. Am I hearing that right, Andrea?
Absolutely. That's exactly how she felt. She knew they were not trying to hurt her, but it really is hard for people in that situation to move on from that.
Okay.
It becomes extremely disincenting for people to take these raises, right? Or to find a job, for example, because they lose the benefits that they so desperately need.
I imagine that's a concept that's lost on a lot of people, right? I mean,
absolutely.
That's going to be new to a lot of people.
Absolutely. I don't think many people who haven't experienced being on public assistance know that some of those criteria are embedded.
Okay. Andrea, thank you. Another recommendation from your report, Angela, said support services need to simultaneously provide both tangible help, like financial help and shelter and food, as well as psychological help. Explain that to us.
Yeah, it can be extremely distressing to be in high amounts of stress trying to survive for an extended period of time. And so what we found, many of the focus groups, I would ask people how they were dealing with the stress. And some of them couldn't come up with positive coping mechanisms. So they went immediately to sort of substance abuse, for example. Some of the folks that we did the focus groups with in the Department of Corrections, house arrest facility, or residential facility, talked about selling drugs as a mechanism to deal with poverty because they just had to resort to these sort of desperate decisions. So thinking about ways in which we can help people cope with this type of stress for a long period of time, I think would be helpful.
Also, this idea, Catherine, from the report, support services need to be provided at times and in formats that are flexible. How do you take that?
I think it's really important that we take into account that the working poor, as we call them, don't have the typical 8-to-5 schedules. So we got to make sure that the services that they need are available to them at times when they can access them, that they have access to childcare, that there's access potentially to transportation to get those services. That entire sort of wraparound idea that in order to receive and benefit from these services, we have to make them truly accessible to people.
One idea that you've expressed, Angela, is this thought in the report that when researchers look at the health and well-being of communities, when the entire populace is doing better, including poor folks, everyone in the community does better, even rich folks. I'm wondering, why is that?
Yeah, so we're all connected, right, in this larger community, and I'm a resident of Johnson County. So I think about, for example, I learned at the UCS Navigating the Future event that there were 400 children in the Olathe School District that experienced homelessness at some point in that previous academic year.
400?
400.
In one school district.
Right. So if I had children in that school district, a child that's experiencing homelessness is not primed to come into the classroom and is ready to learn, right? They're dealing with a whole slew of issues that are happening in an unstable home environment. And so thinking about how that child might disrupt my own child's learning experience, for example, if I'm a wealthy parent, it influences the way that I interact with my child, the way that my child succeeds in school, for example. Also, my taxpaying dollars are going out to support the programs that would support these low-income families.
Yeah.
And so if we can help create more sustainable households, then that money gets rerouted, ideally, to other public infrastructures that we can all sort of benefit from.
Well, just to wrap this up, Catherine, how is United Community Services going to use Angela's good report here? What happens next?
Absolutely. So United Community Services has just finished our own report of the Employment Planning Project, which Dr. Gist's research supported. We'll be publishing it within the next week. And this contains some really specific recommendations about what a community of stakeholders in Johnson County can do to start addressing this issue of low-income employment and to help households increase their income so that they can sustainably meet their household needs. And that will be a report available publicly, and that we hope stakeholders from public policy to funders to social service agencies will take as a call to action.
That's Catherine Evans Madden. She's a project poverty manager for United Community Services of Johnson County. Catherine, thanks very much.
Thank you.
She was joined today by Angela Gist, an associate professor of communication studies over at KU. She conducted this report. Angela, thanks very much.
Thanks. Assistant professor.
Assistant professor. Gotcha. Okay. Tomorrow, meet UMKC's new women's basketball coach and find out what can be done to attract nurses to rural parts of Kansas. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.